Time to take a look at weather and climate on the program. You know, this year, Wisconsin saw its first tornado in February, and 38 more tornadoes have touched down since then, and they caused significant property damage for sure. Fortunately, no one in Wisconsin has been killed by a tornado this year. Texas, not so lucky with the hurricanes. Beryl, when it made landfall, there were some deaths there. And the weather guys are back to talk about why we are seeing more severe storms, among other things. John Martin with us, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
And Steve Ackerman, great to have Steve back, former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW, and of course an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. And Steve, good to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to be back here talking about weather and things.
Weather and things. Yeah, we sometimes get into the things more than the weather.
That's true.
Like power washing our patios.
Oh, but as we talk with these two weather guys, I hope you'll join in. How's the recent wet weather affected you? Have this year's tornadoes, maybe even hurricanes? You might have been on vacation for that. I don't know that the hurricanes affected Wisconsin at all, but
not the recent one. It did affect the East Coast and caused flooding.
We had clouds in the sky from Beryl, but it was nothing. They didn't even rain here.
Yeah. Okay. So, but tornadoes may come to mind, and certainly wet weather. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And if you have a cool weather photo or maybe a cloud formation, something you're interested in, wondering about it, put it in an email, and our weather guys will take a look at it and tell you what they think. That's talk@WPR.org. Well, between May 1st and July 15th, Wisconsin received an unusually high amount of rain.
Yes, it did.
I would agree with that.
Dane County Airport had its wettest May 1st to July 15th ever, going back to 1939.
Wow.
And we were almost 11 inches above normal, and the normal's 11 inches for that period. So we were just about twice our normal precipitation over that interval, which is extraordinary because it's the wet time of year already. So amazing.
So 22 inches during that time, and normally we get
40
inches.
Maybe it's 36
inches.
I think you were going to say that.
It's been creeping up with each decade.
So two-thirds or almost of the annual precipitation in that 75-day period.
So on average, we're not going to get any snow this year.
We don't get snow anymore anyway, so I got to just wean myself off of that expectation.
But we were coming out of a little bit of a droughtier, especially in the north, I think.
It was, and the year before was definitely drier.
Even here in Dane County,
88 or 2012.
You're right. Even here in Dane County, it was bone dry. And one of the ways you can tell, aside from all the water, is no mosquitoes last year compared to this year. Yeah. This year has been incredible.
It's been annoying.
So we're halfway through probably Phil's list of 22 different species that he used to tell us about when we'd come in.
Right.
You know, they come in serial fashion. So you hit your arm in June. It has nothing to do with the bug you kill in August. They're not even related.
My sister has about a half acre lawn to mow out in the country, and I mow that for her. And the mosquitoes, the first time I went over to do it, it was kind of humid anyway, and the mosquitoes got behind my ears.
Oh my God!
And I looked like I'd been a wrestler or a boxer or something because my ears.
Cauliflower ears.
Cauliflower ears for an hour.
What a mess!
Oh man. Well, let's look at June for a minute. So we had a lot of water. Hmm. At June, the Wisconsin State Office of Climatology, actually it was last week, they released its report for June. And the state office said that June was the sixth
wettest. Well, I mean, they're right.
The office has been revolutionized, and it's right on top of the game.
And June of 2023 was the fifth driest.
Yeah, back to back. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
So, and they were calling it precipitation ping pong.
I guess that's sensible. You go from one extreme to the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are the environmental consequences of this ping pong business?
Well, we can say this. It doesn't hurt the mosquitoes to have a bad year.
right.
You know, they can apparently take a dry year like 2023 and rebound right back in 2024. They're robust. I suspect that's a key to many of the ecological niches in the ecosystem. If you get a number of really bad years, whether overly dry or overly wet, I think you start to feel some things on the edges that really get changed and maybe kind of squeezed out. But if it's back and forth one year to the next, I think the ecosystem is so robust it has no trouble with that. Largely, there's bound to be places where it does.
Yeah, I would agree, and that's why they lasted so long. I guess the question of mine is the economy. So what's the business that you have, dry year versus wet year, and particularly ping-ponging might have some, particularly like in agriculture.
I bet.
Or if it gets too bad, you know. So this year we have very high water levels, and so, you know, the volunteer pontooning rides that the Madison will give, they can't do that this year because they can't get under the bridges. I don't know, last year, if it was too dry, they might have been able to not do it because it was too dry.
Yeah. And I had a student many years ago, I don't remember exactly when, and I can't remember his or her name, but it's a really great little report this person wrote for me. They were involved in a family ice cream business up in Minnesota, and they actually got to the point where they bought insurance against a number of rainy days for the summer, because that would really put a crimp in the business. So imagine what it's been like this year for similar types of enterprises. You know, you have so many days where it's cloudy and or rainy that would really put a pressure on a business that deals with sunny summer weather.
So, I'll eat ice cream at any time.
Yeah.
The motivation to get out.
That's the issue. Yeah, that's the issue.
But it did put a crimp on my walk, a couple of block walk over to the local ice cream a couple of times because it was raining.
Right. Yeah, so, it's the last thing you want to do, and yet it's the thing you want to do most in the summer is something
so casual.
I'll just
get the ice cream maker out and make a fresh batch.
And I'll go back to mosquitoes for just a minute because I remember on campus, and this is years ago, we had a building where it had various compartments, weather-like compartments. They could produce a tornado in a little room.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they could make it really dry. And they, like, eliminated... They had some mosquito larvae, and they put the larvae in one of these boxes, and then they just dried it out for a couple of years. Oh. And then they went back and put a couple of drops of water in after 2 years of no moisture at all, and those mosquito larvae just came right to life.
That does not surprise me.
That's unfair right there, but unfortunately true.
Vernon Boyd, Wisconsin, wonders, said there's another heat wave expected in late August through early September. That likely?
I haven't looked at the 30-day forecast, but it's certainly not unprecedented. There are some summers. I'm thinking of, I think, the summer of 2000. We didn't have a day over 90 until September 2nd. So that happens here occasionally. This week that we're in right now in the southern part of the state is bound to be one of those memorable, muggy, warm weeks. If we can get these clouds out of the sky, it'll really warm up today. And that probably will happen. So it's not at all uncommon that August and early September can be almost the worst time of the summer. It's happened before.
Now, here's a tough question for you from Anne. Anne emailed to ask, why are meteorologists called that? What do meteors have to do with the study of weather?
Mm-hmm. Good question. I think it goes back.
They're scratching their heads here.
I think it goes back to Aristotle. He wrote this big book called Meteorologica, and Aristotle was not a particularly good scientist, good thinker, but not a good scientist. But I don't know, it had something to do, he chose that maybe to talk about things that fall in the sky, including meteorites, and then the weather elements got conglomerated onto that. That's the best guess I have, because that is the original source on thinking about the weather is in the West, is that text.
Yeah, I would agree, it must come from the historical...
Well, there you go, Ann. Your question is answered to the best of our ability. The State Climatology Office also reported that January of 2023 to June of 2024. That period was the warmest January to June stretch in state history, with an average temperature of 45.1 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah. Is this a record we should see broken?
I think my answer to that would be yeah.
Me too.
And the reason really what really makes me say confidently is we just had the warmest global average temperature, daily average temperature, just like 2 days ago, three days ago.
Monday and Tuesday last week, back to back.
Right. And it's happening. I mean, and most people now recognize, yes, the climate is changing. The world is warming up, and it's due to what our impacts are in terms of carbon cycles.
I think the hottest average world temperature on record was reached last Monday.
Yeah, something 66 degrees or something
like that. And then the next day beat it.
Yeah, right.
So,
I think it was 62.76 degrees Fahrenheit. And that record was broken the very next day,
Right. It's just...
When they went to 62.87 degrees Fahrenheit.
You go on a global average and increasing that much, that's a huge impact.
It's hard really to put it into perspective, but I'm glad you brought that up, because the globe is a gigantic place, and there's a lot of instruments on it and a lot of people recording this kind of interesting information about the temperature. We've been doing it for 300 plus years in some locations. So... this is not something that's concocted by a bunch of conspiracy theorists. This is just the data.
Yeah.
And an average of a large number of samples is a real strong testimonial to something going on here.
Yeah.
And I've just been told by Joel that the word meteorology comes from the Greek words meteoros, or meteor, and logia.
Oh, for the study
just for
of.
The study of.
The
yeah.
study of. Things high in the air.
Yeah, falling out of the sky or high in the
air.
So
it's pretty much
John was pretty, John was pretty darn close to that.
Pretty darn
well, I appealed to Aristotle, and that's, there you go. And we even talk about precipitation particles as hydromedias, water substance, water objects that fall or reside and fall out of the sky. So
there you go.
Connection there.
Steve Eckerman and John Martin, our guests today, our weather guys. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments, or maybe you've got a photo you want to share as well. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Here we go. We are talking weather and climate today with our weather guys, Steve Eckerman and John Martin from UW. Madison, great to have them back, and lots of callers online. We got some emails. Let's go to Dot in Manitowoc. Dot, hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon. We're talking about the record amount of rain that occurred in May. Had this been winter, what would that translate into feet of snow?
The usual ratio, Dot, is 10 inches of snow to an inch of liquid equivalent of rain. But, so the eight plus inches we got in May would have been 80 inches of snow. That puts you at nearly 7 feet of snow. So that's exceptional and exciting. But sometimes you can have a ratio that gets that exceeds 10 to 1. It can be 15 to 1 or 20 to 1. So 20 inches of snow for 1 inch of rain if it's really cold air in the depths of the winter and you're in the right part of the storm. So it could be even worse than 7 feet, but it would have been about 7 feet on average.
So I'm glad John said it could have been worse than 7 feet, and not it could have been better. Yeah, 7 feet long is love for snow.
It's just as easy to shovel a 20 to 1 as it is a 10 to 1. It weighs the same.
True.
So it's more fun.
So where would it be? Is there some other, along the lake or something, Lake Michigan or Lake Superior?
A lot of times the lake effect snow has a higher snow to liquid equivalent ratio. So that's a place like up in Superior or Bayfield might get 15 to 20 to 1 more frequently than we do down here.
Yeah. Philip in Presque Isle, we'll go to you now. Hi, Philip.
Yes, thank you. I had heard your comments about climate change, and I was curious about a couple of things. I had read that actually the global climate was warmer during the Renaissance period than it is today. I would like to get your comments on that. Secondly, Is anything being done? You know, I know in the United States and Europe, a lot of effort is being put into reducing carbon emissions, but according to my reading, since 2000, where we've reduced carbon emissions, and so has Europe, China and India are up 200 and 143% respectively. And so I'd welcome your thoughts on that as to how we could maybe make this a global initiative.
Yeah.
That's a good question. A good couple of questions. I can start with the so-called medieval warm period. There was a period in, from 1200 to about 1500, I think, that was a little bit warmer than the subsequent several hundred years, and the notably warmer grain production was greater and all that, and I think it ended somewhere after the plague. But that's why the population was so large in the mid-14th century, and so the plague came along and took care of that in ways that we hope never happens again. Mm. But I don't know, two things, whether or not it was warmer then than it is now. It's hard to say because there were no instruments measuring it. So I think there were other ways to make a guess about that from paleo records, but I don't know what the answer is on that, whether or not the medieval warm period was warmer than currently. I guess I suspect the answer is no, but I don't know that that's the case. And then on the other one, you can say something if you want.
Yeah, and I think in the other one, you're right. I mean, this is a global issue, carbon dioxide. When things get into the atmosphere, they spread around. And that's why we need these world organizations working together to try and ameliorate what is going on. It doesn't surprise me that in the politics of China and India and the need as they grow, that they would be producing more. I'm not saying that that's right, but if that's what the data is showing, it doesn't surprise me.
It just adds incentive, though, for us to figure out what's the next source of energy. Because if we figure it out first, those very countries that make the argument, as Steve points out, that they need a period to develop the way that all the countries in the West had when there were no regulations, if we have the energy technology to sell them, we'll be in a really nice position rather than waiting for somebody else to figure it out. And then they're in that great position. So that's why the race to the next non-petroleum energy is so important for our country to win. And we can't win it without resolve.
And that's why it's so exciting to me reading in the Madison paper, this fusion.
Yeah, that's right.
Researchers in Wisconsin, in the university here, are teaming up with companies and they're really making those breakthroughs of using fusion for energy.
Somebody's going to figure it out. Yeah, it might as well be
they're
us.
On the path now.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's very exciting.
Just talking with some folks last week about that from the College of Engineering here. So, yeah, there's some exciting stuff down the road. In terms of just a global interest or a global push to do this, I mean, we have, I think we had some pretty good global exercises when it comes to refrigerant, for example. I think we may have talked about that. That's one where everybody said, okay, we're going to get rid of
Freons, right?
Freon.
Yeah. CFCs.
CFCs, yeah.
And pretty much everybody did it.
Yeah.
And those holes.
The ozone hole, got repaired.
It repaired itself. And that was only 1987 that we were kind of saying, this is dire and we need these rules. And what is it now? It's 37 years later, which is the blink of a geologic eye. Things are repaired. So, yeah, we can do that. I think there's, in those 37 years, there's been an erosion in confidence and expertise. I mean, we had the Paris Accords at the end of the Obama administration, and they were not kept going by the subsequent administration. And that was a climate accord that actually did start to say, hey, developing countries will make some accommodation for you, but not forever. Let's agree that it can't be forever. And so now we don't have that accord anymore. So we've got to start again. Because certain viewpoints in our country think this is not an issue. I think they're wrong about that.
Well, we know they're wrong about that.
Yeah, yeah, we do know we're wrong. We've concluded they're wrong
about
it.
We have the data that shows it.
Yeah.
Alan in Ripon has a totally different question, I believe. Let's go there. Alan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. In 1950, I was a Marine aerographer at Cherry Point, North Carolina. And we released a pie ball, and it went up about 50 or 100 feet. Instead of going up more, it headed east and stayed at the same level for a ways. And then it came back. Then it went so far, and then it went straight up into the air. Well, what happened is that a shear had taken place, and a demonstration to the congressman of marine tactics to dive bomb a enemy, of course, but it was done to drop in the middle of the runways. And the pilot came down, and all of a sudden his plane broke into many pieces.
Mm.
He was killed.
And it was, it was a wind shear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've had some, you know, even more modern aircraft have run into problems with wind shear.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That was that was decades ahead of, I think, the impetus for instrumenting a whole bunch of airports. Stapleton Airport, which is now Denver International, has a really sophisticated low-level wind shear detection operation because there were some flights that had trouble in Denver in the 70s that were related to this kind of problem. Really,
so if the wind
really
changes direction really quickly, they lose lift.
Yeah, and there's no way to recover because they're close to the ground. Yeah.
And wind shears, of course... Derecho's are wind shear. Are they wind shears?
They'll generate wind shear.
Yeah. Okay.
Really strong winds. They're outflow from thunderstorms, technically. But if you all get hit by one of those and you're coming in and you don't know that it's there, then you can go from, well, actually, if you're leaving one,
right.
You can go from, you know, really good headwinds, which are going to give you lift, to no headwinds.
Yeah, and you just crash.
Yeah.
Bad news.
Or you could, and I was thinking back to the wind shears, or the derechos of the 1980, was it? Was a really bad one in Wisconsin that took down so many.
Oh, yeah, the pine trees up north, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they lay, and that's where you know you have those, not tornadoes, but straight line winds or things like derechos, where all the trees are just flattened in the same direction.
Yeah, like matchsticks.
Yeah.
You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to David in Northeast Iowa. Hi, David.
I've got a question. About two and a half weeks ago when Northeast Iowa was having tornadic activity and stuff around in our area, and my wife and I noticed it was a long, thunderous roar that kept going for over a half an hour. And it was like, how can it thunder that long in our area?
Rolling thunder. We had that, actually,
that's
David,
right.
We had that in Madison, Sinto. Wisconsin, and elsewhere around the state, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happened?
So there's two things. One is it's not just one storm, right?
Yeah.
There's multiple storms, and each one generating lightning and thunder. And imagine it's the thermal structure of the lower atmosphere. Well, that'll also determine how far those sound waves propagate.
Mm.
And then they reverberate off the storms.
Yeah, and a lot of the storms we had this summer had a squall line sort of structure to them. Our city here in Madison, you'd get just a little intersection with a portion of that squall line with the real rain and wind. But as Steve points out, there's a whole line of storms in every direction, north, south, and north and south of where you are. And so they're all making a cacophony of their own, and you can hear them.
Yeah.
So they just keep rolling, and they're not in sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah, but David, it was an amazing sound for me, too.
Yeah.
for a lot of people.
A lot of people noticed
that. Because it just never stopped.
Yeah, it was awesome, yeah.
It was just rolling thunder. So there you go. So it was several storms going on there, David, that were creating that issue. Thank you for calling.
And if they're at a distance, you don't see the lightning.
You just hear the lightning.
What's going on? You see a lot of it from your own storm, so you're not going to be distracted even if you could. But the sound resounds all over the place.
Dean in Milwaukee, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dean.
Hi, guys. We're visiting from Colorado. Our son lives here in Milwaukee. I think we exchanged periods
of smoke
for whiffs of we traded smoke for whiffs of mildew. But I've been wanting to follow up since last month. I didn't get the call back. The question was about how we measure how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. And I worked for the USGS for 3 decades, and what we were using were infrared gas analyzers, which basically measure the attenuation of infrared light due to the absorption of by carbon dioxide molecules, basically the same kind of process that goes on in the so-called greenhouse effect, but using instruments to more precisely measure how much attenuation there is. So anyway, that's what we and a large group of scientists, excuse me, and NOAA and NASA and elsewhere have been using at the Earth's surface. And one of the involvements I had was with a Wisconsin guy, John Norman. You perhaps know him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good friend.
Very well, yeah.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, he was on my PhD committee when I was in Nebraska.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that for you. No, he's a great guy, as you point out.
Yeah.
Indeed, indeed. You know, so here's my proposition. I wanted to ask you, considering the constituents of the atmosphere, nitrogen, oxygen, water vapors after argon, number four, if we're humidifying or increasing the temperature of the Earth's surface, thereby allowing the presence of more water vapor in the atmosphere, you think we may be increasing the surface pressure of the atmosphere?
Hmm. Fractionally, but the problem is water vapor rains out. Yeah. So it's only going to reside for about 9 days. At a particular location, if you add water vapor to the atmosphere, like through transpiration of corn, I think if you had a sensitive enough instrument, you might recognize a pressure increase, but it'd be fractional. I have colleagues at North Carolina State who are looking on the other end of the problem, where if you have a huge condensation event or deposition event to make ice out of the vapor in the context of a storm, on a continental scale, how much pressure deficit is accrued by getting the water vapor, which has mass but no longer is gas when it turns to water or ice? How much pressure deficit do you have? It's on the order of about 5 millibars in the most intense storms. So that's, half a percent of the total mass of the atmosphere. So I think, and that's in the context of a really extreme storm. So though what you're saying is right, I think it's fractional and probably not that big.
Yeah.
No. There you go, Dean. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Koki in central Wisconsin, on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, yes. I live in the Middle East, and
we lost her. She had a question about methane being produced by hydrologic dams.
Hmm. Hydrologic dams?
How would that work? I don't really know.
Yeah, when we put our junk and store stuff, right? We always see the flames are burning off the methane.
Yeah, yeah.
But hydrological dams, I don't.
Maybe if you make a giant lake where there shouldn't be a lake, you could produce extra methane because it's biology in the water.
Could be,
maybe
right.
That's it. I don't know how much you do.
I can tell you now with all the seaweed or the lake weed that's dying, it's generating.
Yeah, you probably noticed something. Yeah.
We've got her. I think.
Got her back.
Yeah, I thought we had her back, but we lost her. So maybe she'll send us an email, and we'll get to that. Ken in Toma says he's aware that El Nino is changing. How will that affect us in Wisconsin this coming winter? More snow, colder temperatures, or what?
Well, yeah, generally the rule is when there's a robust El Nino, as there was last year, and the El Nino is when the equatorial Pacific Ocean surface temperatures are warmer than normal, at about the dateline or further to the west, or further to the east, then that tends to make us wetter and a little bit warmer. So we don't get as much snow. And it's a pretty strong signal. When it's the opposite, when it's a La Nina, where the temperatures either relax back or actually get colder than they should be at the central part of the Pacific equatorial, then we don't have as strong a signal. So it's a bit of a mixed bag on that. So I think we've relaxed back since last winter to what we are now.
Yeah, we're moving into another El Nino, right?
Is that right? I don't know.
Yeah, I think the La Nina that we were in went away pretty quickly.
Oh, okay.
This is another
double-barreled event?
Yeah. I haven't checked in a month, but last month I didn't even check that frequently.
So then maybe that's it. Maybe we're looking at another snowless winter here, or relatively so. It's just unfortunate.
It depends on how big your driveway is.
exactly.
And what you want to do with it.
Right.
Miles in Oregon, Wisconsin, emailed to ask, is there anything new happening in the field of meteorology that has the weather guys excited?
Yeah. You start.
Yeah. I mean, we're getting ready to launch another series of weather satellites, which is always exciting because it gives us the ability to globally better monitor what the weather is. I think the other thing that I really find exciting to see how it's going to be used is artificial intelligence. And so I always thought the artificial intelligence, when you're going to make a weather forecast, you need to take all these variety of data and use and get them into some uniform and consistent format. And AI can help do that. I think also in terms of forecasting precipitation movements of thunderstorms, you know, I always fire up my free radar app and take a look at what's going on and try and imagine how it's going to move. And I think AI, again, in those short-term forecasts, are going to be pretty good.
Yeah, it is going to be really good.
I saw that NOAA did a climate forecast with AI, and I was just like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
But because I don't think that we have the data, even though we know that we have this general warming trend, I wouldn't trust AI. So I think I'm kind of excited to see how it all pans out.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I wouldn't have thought of that one, and I think it's a really good one. I'm interested in just a couple of questions, I guess. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but one of them is one of my new graduate students is recently in work we've been doing. We've discovered that the two-jet structure of the wintertime in the northern and southern hemisphere dissolves into a single jet structure at the tropopause in the warm season. And it seems to me nobody has really said that until now. And so there's maybe some implications for spring and summer weather in the northern and southern hemispheres that we didn't know about before. So that's going to be fun to explore that. And another thing is we're thinking about what happens at the transition from the winter into the spring. So far, only in the northern hemisphere. But what happens in the wintertime is that a whole bunch of these vortices get created by the cooling on top of clouds in the Arctic night. And these vortices can take various shapes and sizes. The big ones have the ability to make storms in the middle latitudes during the transition. And they get evacuated from the high latitudes only under certain conditions in certain years have preferential export. So we have a suspicion that the interannual, that is year-to-year variability of storminess, and think about how important that is. Trees pollinate themselves depending on April winds. That's how they work. And the interannual variability of storminess is going to have something to do with the nature and the size of these disturbances that grow clandestinely in the Arctic night. So we're looking at that. Yeah. So I'm excited about everything.
Yeah, right. That's why we're the weather guys.
Yeah.
Our weather guys with us today. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I haven't seen any photos yet. We usually get one or two. At least you could email your weather photo along with maybe a question relating to it. How somebody else has emailed in, how is climate change affecting the amount of turbulence on flights?
That's a great question. Yeah. I don't know
the answer to that. Yeah.
You know, we were just talking about ideas we're excited about is another one I wasn't going to talk about, but the fronts that form near the tropopause at the upper part of the troposphere, about 10 kilometers above the ground, they have an inordinate amount of influence on turbulence. And I have a suspicion that they may be changing in their frequency and their character in the slightly warming climate. So it would be directly related to that question, but I don't know the answer yet. I hope to investigate it.
That's a really interesting question. And, we used to get it from planes making those observations, but now I think they can sense where it is. And now we're not having the observations that we used to have.
Yeah,
because they're going up and down around, and they're up 5 miles, aren't they?
Right. Yeah, yeah. Or higher sometimes. Yeah.
Or sometimes higher. Yeah. So there you go. Matthew emailed to ask if the warmest global temperatures recorded last week were measured in the shade. Given there is less and less shade in the world, would it make more sense to measure temperatures in direct sunlight? Would this not give people a better idea of how easy it is to overheat when they're not protected by shade?
So, yeah, most of those temperatures will be in shelters.
Yeah.
And so they're shaded from direct sunlight, although they have space so air can flow through it and they don't get overheated that way.
They're ventilated, but they're not exposed to the strong winds either.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the standard.
Yeah. Still tornado season in Wisconsin, by the way, and we had 39 tornadoes touch down already, and I think what's the average? 23, I think.
Is 20, mid, below 20, 22, mid 20s, 23, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
So is there a connection, the question is there a connection between climate change and the frequency and strength of tornadoes?
That's a really hard one, especially if you zero in on a state like ours or any state just by itself. This spring and early summer, we've had a lot of convective activity, more than we normally get, and that almost always comes along with the threat of severe weather. So those two have gone hand in hand. Whether or not that's a direct consequence this summer of the change in the climate is very hard to say. However, the climate's warming. There's more water vapor in the atmosphere. It's probably easier to produce some of these severe thunderstorms. The ones that spawn tornadoes might have characteristics that don't care so much just about water vapor. There's other characteristics that have to feed in. So it's a difficult question to answer. I don't think we really know for sure yet.
It was interesting to me. I think we've only had, I was reading somewhere, we've had five F5 tornadoes in the state in recorded.
Oh, all time?
Yeah, that had been recorded.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I'm only going to add the word, thankfully.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
Yeah.
Bonneville was one of them in 84.
Yeah.
Plainfield was probably another one.
Another one, right.
Yeah. And those are, you know, a relatively recent vintage, the last 40 years.
And very destructive.
Yeah.
And one they thought was an F5, but they didn't have a way to measure it, was the one in New Richmond, and that was in 1899. And that one literally destroyed the business district of New Richmond and killed 117 people, I think, and injured another 125 or so.
Wow.
You know, I just read an article, I think it was in AMS or associated with a newsletter from them, about the revisiting the this tornado scale, the enhanced Fujita tornado scale, which is based on the damage that the tornado does. And so now they're raising questions we always know that the buildings are getting stronger, but it's also not just about how strong the tornado is and the damage that it does. Yeah. It's also how big it is.
Right.
And they're doing the same thing with hurricanes. Right, it's not always just about the winds anymore. It's about how much precipitation is associated with them.
Storm surge and all that. Yeah, right, the impact that it has.
So they're reevaluating how you measure that severity.
Right.
It's probably a good thing to do.
And then I think one of the ancillary questions will become, how do we go back and redo
it?
Kinds of analyses. Yeah. And here you're talking about it, Larry. There was no Fujita scale.
No.
There was no construction like there is today in 1899. And so it's hard to make an estimate.
Yeah. Tim in Beloit has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Yes, I want to go back to that very interesting question about the changes in atmospheric pressure with regard to the amount of moisture in the atmosphere. I read recently that the National Park Service can no longer guarantee that helicopters can come to the rescue of stranded hikers in very hot places like in Death Valley, because the density of the atmosphere is so thin because of the high temperature. And I was wondering if the weathermen wanted to comment on that topic, and I'll just take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
I think in a related way, the runway at Phoenix International is one of the longer ones in the country. Because when it's warm there in the summer, it can be, of course, days can be well over 100 degrees in Phoenix in the Sun Valley. you need a long runway to get enough lift under the same size wing that takes off, you know, later in the day in Logan Airport in Boston, where it's 55 degrees. So that's a factor. It definitely is. The density of the air makes a difference in how much lift can be generated on a wing at a given airspeed. So I suspect it's true for helicopters.
Oh, yeah, I definitely would say that as well, except I don't know if they would. I mean, I think they would want to put out a warning, but I wonder if that's just during the daytime when it would get too hot.
Yeah, I guess the nighttime would be.
So maybe the rescue may have to occur at night, which might be even harder because they might be able to find them.
But you're right. I mean, it cools down nicely in the desert.
Dick in Eau Claire has a question for you. Dick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about global warming, and obviously now I think we're trying to slow it and eventually stop it, which probably will take decades. But is there a chance in the future to reverse it?
Boy, there have been talks about how would you do that, right? And so as we were talking about straight-line winds earlier and trees going down, trees are a storage of carbon dioxide. Mm. So there have been ways where people have been looking at, if we can get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, where do we store it? And then the question is, how long is that storage? It's not going to necessarily go. When trees die, the carbon dioxide goes back into the atmosphere. So I think, you know, it's important to be reducing the amount of carbon dioxide that we're putting in the atmosphere. But as John was saying earlier, it's also, we need new energy mechanisms. And things like fusion are not going to generate carbon dioxide.
Yeah, I mean, it could happen as fast as possible if one of these things comes online. If we suddenly have fusion as an available energy source, or we really go to town on solar and wind and make the battery storage better and all that, we'll quickly drop petroleum. It just won't compete financially. Right. It'll be the worst investment you can make. And then carbon dioxide resides about 60 years. It takes a while to come out of the atmosphere. I think that maybe one of the questions underlying the broad question there is, what will be the goal of reductions? And I think it would probably be the pre-industrial concentration, which we do know. It's about 300, 320 parts per million. Because if we had control over that, we might decide, some evil scientists decide, let's bring it down to 200 and make a global ice age or something. We kind of know what the carbon dioxide fraction ought to be to have, conditions that we all could agree are habitable. So about 300 parts per million would probably be where we'd shoot for, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't heard about that.
They're going to have to start thinking about that at some point.
They're going to have to start talking about it at some point.
Yeah.
There are machines that'll take the carbon dioxide out of the air. They're researching on that, and they're winding up with it in blocks of some sort that they can bury.
Right. Yep. But then they're buried, they're not gone.
They're not gone.
But the ocean has tons of carbon dioxide in it that's out of play for thousands of years, too, we think, in the deep ocean. So maybe we already play this COD game a little bit, just on giant timescales. Right. So,
Chris in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Yes, hello. I heard your question about aircraft performance in extreme heat, and thought I'd add just one point of interest. I'm a retired airliner pilot. Flew Boeing 767 and the occasion will occur in places such as Phoenix, El Paso, other desert-type communities. If the ambient temperature exceeds 50 degrees Celsius, all operations tend to stop. It's about 122 Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And on two occasions, I've been unable to depart Phoenix for several hours, got to wait for it to cool down. It's not that the aircraft is physically incapable of flying, but Boeing's published data tables were only drawn out to 50 C. Anything above that, you're in uncharted territory.
Yeah, nobody wants. Yeah, wow. Nobody wants to do that.
Nobody wants to do that. Wow. That's really interesting. Chris, thank you.
Wow.
Appreciate the call. we have a photo Daniel emailed to ask you guys to explain the red sky and warning sailor take warning. And Daniel shared a photo of a sunrise as an example.
Yeah, that's a gorgeous,
that's beautiful
photo.
Yeah.
It's reflected in the lake, and it's all red sky, which you get. He's got a lot of clouds in there because that's when you really get the reflection.
Yeah.
But yeah, red sky at night, sailor's delight, because The sun is setting in the west. Red sky at night.
So the clouds are to your east. You're seeing the red.
Right. And so
presumably.
The storm has gone by.
Yeah.
And so you're okay. Red sky in morning, sailors take warning because the storm is coming your way.
Yeah. If you're that's in the only northern hemisphere. The really important characteristic that you just brought up is that you're looking at the opposite horizon from where the sun is.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Here is an example where the sun's coming up and it's red. Yeah. And which, of course, is possible. And so it would make you think, and these aren't clouds that look like they're going to be particularly nasty during the day, but even so, those clouds are on their way to the east. So right. This is a little bit weird, you know?
This is why folk sayings are great, but, you know, I'm pulling out my National Weather Service forecast.
Right? Or at least read the footnotes, you know, because it can't always, doesn't always tell you what you think it does.
Right.
But it's a beautiful picture.
Yeah.
Bob in Jacksonport wonders if there's any landforms or bodies of water in Wisconsin that affect the weather.
Lake Michigan surely does.
Yeah,
Lake Superior. I mean, Lake Superior does. Yeah, those are huge influences on the local climate of much of the state, not just the immediate coastlines of them. So, those are two that stand out. I don't know if Lake Oshkosh is whatever this is. Is it Fond du Lac Lake? I don't know what the lake is up there.
No, Oshkosh, right? Lake Fond du Lac. It's Lake Fond du Lac, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know if that's quite big enough except to be local. I don't think it has a big statewide impact, but it's kind of an extension of the Green Bay anyway.
It's it's a very shallow lake, too, and I'm pretty sure that would not have enough.
But locally, I mean, I was at Steve's house on Saturday afternoon, and out in the front part of his house, he's right on the water in the north part of Lake Mendota. We talked about it.
Yeah.
On the front part of the house, You walk out to the driveway. It's a pretty warm day on Saturday. You go out to the backyard, which is on the lake, and it's 5 degrees cooler.
Cooler, yeah.
It was noticeably cooler.
Yeah.
So locally, there's always an impact, no matter the size of the water.
You might get enhanced snowfall if the lake hasn't frozen yet.
Right.
Well, and the weather forecast, if you're in Milwaukee driving, they always say they'll give a temperature and then warmer or whatever, or cooler.
Cooler near
Lake Michigan.
And it's true.
Yeah.
And you can see the cloud edge on a relatively quiescent day. The cloud edge will be to the east of Waukesha as the lake breeze makes its way inland. And you can see little clouds sprout right on the edge of it. It's pretty cool.
You guys talked about the atmospheric cold pool.
Oh, yeah.
This is one of John's favorite topics.
It is, yeah.
In fact, I think, did you invent that term?
I think I did,
What does it mean?
I look at the air temperature at about a mile above sea level, so I want to get away from the ground to see if it's still a climate signal, because it would be uncontaminated if so, and it is. So we're a mile above the ground, and I just measure the aerial extent of air that's colder than -5 degrees Celsius at 1 mile above the ground. That's what I call the cold pool. And we just passed mid-July is when it shrinks to nothing in the northern hemisphere. So we're already, I mean, even we have a beautiful warm summer week coming ahead, it's already expanding at high latitude. And it's coming. The winter is coming already. So I love the cold pool. It always keeps me interested no matter what time of year. Right now, in the middle of the summer, I know the winter is coming because I can see it every day.
I can see it every day in the cold pool.
Yep.
So what is it again if it's gone?
If it's gone, which happens every summer for a few days in mid-July, and the exact date when it disappears goes from year to year differently. But then by this time, in the end of July, it's starting to grow again. Minuscule growth right up around the North Pole, but you can see it, and every day it encroaches farther and farther south. It's very exciting.
And I'll add that it's not that Don just likes cold weather. He likes snow.
Yeah, that's right.
And you
that's
can't right. get snow if it's not cold.
And you can't, so I need that -5 line down here in Madison. It'll get here by about the end of November. So,
on that happy note, thank you guys both, and we will look forward to your next visit in August. See what the weather's like then.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Last Monday of August. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests today, from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve's an emeritus professor. John, of course, a professor and former chair. And thank you for listening. I tell you what, lots of people help make this show a reality. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.